Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are positively past election. Let's see here. Almost up on a Super Bowl, but down in Annapolis, it's 12 months and 365. Don Mahler joins us now, all on behalf of our friends at State Fair and our friends at El Guapo over on Frederick Road. And I was over at Fadley's last week picking up a crab cake. I got some fresh fish over there at Fadley's in Lexington Market. My wife didn't think she liked fish, but I think she's starting to like fish now. I'm starting to fry it up, do it the right way. Fadley's delivers crab cakes wherever you are. And, of course, State Fair, you can stop by curbside, get some chicken and waffles. Don, you have put this one together. We reporter types don't get together anymore, right? So you've decided that everyone that covers the State House should all come together under the Baltimore Positive flag. And tell us what's going on down there, right?
I mean, these three folks usually hang out down in the basement of the State House over in a little corner, and they have the secret handshake and the whole routine. But so we thought we'd bring them together. We have three of the really best reporters in the entire state: Brian Sears from the Daily Record, Pam Wood from the Baltimore Sun, and Josh Kurtz from Maryland Matters. Welcome, guys and gals. Great to have you back on Baltimore Positive. You're all veterans.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be with you.
Yeah, glad to be here. But, you know, there's no handshakes this year because, no, you know, the pandemic, no super right. handshakes. Yeah.
Is it a wink or something? What happens?
It's more like a nod.
Right.
So how different is it? Maybe get a reaction from each one of you. How different is it in trying to cover the State House and all that goes on without really being able to be down there and mingle and hang with staff? And, I mean, it seems to me that's sort of the essence of your existence. Pam, why don't you start us off and talk a little bit of how different it is, and then we'll get Brian and Josh to jump in.
Well, you can see from our videos, none of us is at the State House right now. We are all at our homes in our home offices. We are down there sometimes in person, but, you know, politics and governing is a person-to-person affair, and so much of it is remote because of the pandemic. They're not having daily floor sessions where we can run up and grab lawmakers and ask them questions for our stories. There's no in-person committee hearings. All the testimony is by video. So as with everything in the world, we're just, a lot of what we're doing is looking at our computer screens. And it's hard. It's hard because we can only get people on the phone or by text. And it's really harder to pin down our lawmakers and the lobbyists and the advocates to find out what's going on.
In a perfect world here, they could get together. What are the limitations from Zoom as you guys see it? Things that they're struggling more with. I mean, you've mentioned the fact that you could, in a room on one day, speak with a dozen lawmakers by accident or just run into them, or you literally have to make an appointment. In my sports business, I haven't spoken to a football player in a year. And it's what I do as well, or what I used to do anyway. I would say for what they're trying to do in governance 11 months into this, what are the limitations and the real problems in covering this? And more than that, in having verification for what we all would like as journalists, which is knowing we're reporting the truth.
Look, I think some of the challenges, you know, it really stem from not being able to be there. It's hard, you know, when you go to a floor session or a committee session in person, you can read the room a little bit. When there's testimony going on, you can look around the room and see, you know, who's nodding in approval, who's perhaps, you know, making a face or checking out.
So there is a secret wink.
there's that. I mean, it was really odd for me this week. I've made a point of making sure that I'm in Annapolis any day that the House or the Senate is meeting on the floor, even if it's a pro forma session where they're just introducing bills. And it was really odd for me to sit in, you know, not on the floor of the Senate where I typically am, but in the gallery, and to be the only reporter. You know, and by the way, you know, reporters were, I guarantee you reporters were watching, but, you know, most of them are probably smarter than me and decided to not show up. But to sit up there by myself and realize that, like, you know, all of my colleagues are scattered, it's kind of an odd feeling.
Was there benefit to it? I flew to Houston to see a football game. I sat on the roof. I came home and I said, I'm not doing that again. You know, there was no benefit to it from a work standpoint.
I think, I think early on, there's probably little benefit. But as we get into later parts of the session, especially in the House, when it's really important that there are certain numbers of people on the floor for votes and things like that, I think it's going to be really important for us to be there and to actually sort of, for lack of a, to use a sports term, to referee it a little bit and to know whether or not there are enough men on the field to do what they're doing.
Josh, you really, I'm trying to think in terms of what you and the folks at Maryland Matters do. You cover the news, but you also have, I think it seems to me, part of your brand is the story behind the story that you pick up in the hallways or at Franny O'Brien's or at Harry Brown's. How do you fill those blanks in?
I'm pulling out my hair trying to answer that question. Actually, I'll probably look like Brian pretty soon. That's
Brian. I want to note that's the first bald joke today, Brian.
Brian, I've been growing my hair long. I'll give you some of mine.
I say that lovingly.
I'm not bald. I'm aerodynamic.
That's right. No, I mean, that's something we've been talking about a lot, and I think it's always harder early in the session to figure out kind of what the backstories are. And I'm hoping that those will emerge and we'll be able to pursue them anyway. But yeah, it's, as my colleagues have said, you benefit so much from just wandering the halls and the serendipity of running into people. And what I've told my staff is, when you're not watching a hearing, when you're not watching a floor session, kind of imagine you're in the hallway and who are five people you might run into, give them a call because maybe they know something, that's sort of the, at an elemental level, what we can do to try to recreate it, but it's going to be tough and it's really aggravating.
I remember the importance of that whole relationship and showing up thing long before Pam Wood arrived on the scene and was ever present in the county office building. I remember one of her many predecessors was very angry with me one day. And I know it's hard for you guys to believe, but was angry with me and was really angry at me because of Brian Sears. And she accused me, this particular reporter, of scooping Brian Sears with all of the quote unquote good stuff. And I asked her to identify what the good stuff was. And it was basically testimony from work sessions and individual conversations with council members or department heads. And I said to her at that point, you understand, I don't know, and Brian, maybe you pick up on this, I don't think, and Pam as well, because you lived out there, I don't think Brian has any magic sauce here. I think he's showing up. I think he goes and sits through really boring work sessions in hopes to get one or two tidbits or hear something about a bill that's under the radar that nobody knows about. And then he comes down and bugs the daylights out of me until I give him more information about that bill. Brian, is that an accurate description?
Look, I think it's, there's a lot to be said about showing up. There's a lot to be said about people seeing that you're there and that you care about particular issues, because later on they remember that you were there and you cared about a particular issue. There's a lot to be said about a lesson that I learned a long time ago from a former state delegate turned Baltimore County councilman who once yelled at me in a profanity-laced tirade about reading the bills. And so there's a lot to be said about doing things like reading all of the bills and talking to everybody. I mean, Dutch Ruppersberger once told me that politics was all about relationships, but so is reporting and talking to everybody. And asking people sometimes, hey, what's going on out there that's not getting some attention that probably deserves to get some attention? There, you never know what you don't know, and so there's for me it was always a lot of that. And Don, as you well know, because you and I go back a little ways. I mean, I covered Baltimore County for a lot of years. I mean, so those were a lot of the faces don't change, even though they sort of change positions year to year. So, I was a known commodity. I mean, that being around for a long time helps.
Institutional knowledge, right?
Absolutely. Pam, what's your take on that in terms of, because you've done both now. You've lived out there on the mezzanine and up on the council floor. and now you're down in Annapolis. What strategy do you bring to it?
Yeah, I also in the past covered Annapolis City Hall, College Park City Hall, and Anne Arundel County government too. So I've done a tour of local and state governments. Being prepared and being present is important, as Brian said. Read the agendas, know when they come out, read the bills, read the fiscal notes, which are like the summaries, know what's going to happen. And I would, always make sure I would go to, say, a work session in Baltimore County, even if there was nothing really stellar on the agenda, because you just never know what you're going to learn or what you're going to find out or who's going to come up next to you and say, oh, hey, Pam, you should know about this. And that's something that is difficult in this remote world because the newsmakers don't see you there. We're watching, not even on Zoom. All the lawmakers are on Zoom, but we're just external watching on YouTube. So they don't see that I'm sitting there in Annapolis. Normally they see me sitting at the press desk and they say, oh, all right, the Baltimore Sun is interested in this, or, oh, I want to talk to the Baltimore Sun about something else. And, they'll give you a tip, and not just lawmakers, but the lobbyists, the advocates, and they're not present either. So, I sometimes feel right now like I'm in this hole, like I'm in a little closet somewhere and nobody's seeing, what I'm doing. So it is quite a challenge because that being present helps a lot in reporting.
Well, before we jump to the specifics of the General Assembly, and boy, it's starting to pick up, although the first week or two was so quiet, I thought this really feels different to me. And part of that, I think, was the fact that you all weren't there to tell us what was going on in the hallways. I mean, it was so quiet. It was almost like that old thing, quiet out there, what's too quiet. And it was just kind of odd. But before we jump to the General Assembly, Josh, maybe we start with you and then go around the panel again. I want to talk about a national issue for a minute, and that is press relationships in general with the administrations or the people they cover. Because like everyone else in America right now, I have this crush on Jen Psaki, and the change in tone that she's brought to the White House briefing room that then to me continued recently, when Tony Blinken came out at the State Department and said they were going to reinstitute daily briefs and that he, as the Secretary of State, would be appearing regularly. And I turned to my wife and I said, I wonder if people understand this is actually pretty normal. What we are celebrating is a return to normal. This isn't extraordinary, but it feels extraordinary. As three reporters, I'm wondering your take on the first sort of dip in the water of the Biden administration and their relationships with the press.
The first thing I'll say is I knew Jen Psaki when she was a pup on the Hill in the early 2000s. So she's a really nice person and very good at her job. I think the return to normal is great, and there's something really reassuring about it. I almost think that there's not a danger in the fact that normalcy has returned, but I think there is a danger of reporters being almost like too in love with the fact that it's back. And after 4 years of just like chaos and hostility and sort of unspeakable working conditions, are they going to get too comfortable, too cozy with the newsmakers, give them too much leeway, not ask tough questions? I mean, I think that's something everybody kind of has to be on alert for. But I would say just in general, it's great and it's about time. And it's hard to believe that, basically we went 4 years without that kind of level of normal.
Brian, you and Pam both nodded your head. As soon as Josh said, I'm worried a little bit that the press is enamored with this new normal and maybe losing some of their edge. You both nodded. I just want you to react as to why you nodded.
I watched that first press conference with Jen Psaki and was really fascinated to see the difference in tone. And as we got to the end, I turned to my wife, who's a former reporter, and I said, she went an entire hour or so, and she didn't call anybody the enemy of the people, and she didn't insult anyone and didn't, you know, and I said, you know,
well, she's obviously
like
intelligent as well, which puts it a step ahead of the last one.
It was almost like an abusive relationship. Like I said, I wonder if reporters know what to do with someone who doesn't hit them. And then I immediately said, you know what, this is my concern about this is that they're going to get so used to the non-confrontational style that it's going to either seem like it's a willingness to sort of accept what you're being told. And the fact of the matter is that Jen Psaki has a job. Her job is to present the point of view of the administration and to sometimes tell you that what seems black or navy blue is really charcoal gray. And it is the press's job to sort of dig in and figure out what the, you know, what the nuances are and what is not being certain and what is not being presented, or to come back at them with what is not being presented and ask them to weave that in and tell you how that fits together. And we saw that happen a lot with the Trump administration, and I'm worried, at least initially, and maybe my fears will be unfounded, that, you know, that it might seem too easy to just forget to do that.
Pam, you know, what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, if I could add, the approach of the press secretary and the press secretary White House press corps relationship is only one small part of reporting on the federal government. It's the most visible part. It's what everybody sees on TV. But past administrations, Trump administration, Obama administration, you know, the entire time I've been an adult, I don't deal with the federal government a lot, but the federal agencies are generally terrible about Freedom of Information Act requests. They take years to fulfill requests for documents. And they're really terrible about giving on the record comments. Like, say I write a story about maybe the Chesapeake Bay Foundation is suing the EPA. That's something that happens. You call the EPA, ask them to talk about it, and they'll say, we don't comment on pending litigation, or we will defend our law. And they'll want it attributed to a spokesperson, or they'll say that on background. And it's like, that is basic information. That is a load of BS that you can't have a spokesperson attach their name to a very basic statement. And I often push back and say, maybe that works inside the Beltway, but I'm an outside the Beltway reporter. My editors won't let me have an anonymous comment from a federal agency. And I have to press just to get them to attach their name to something basic. So that kind of crap, that's got to change. And, you know, you can't just give the Biden administration plaudits for, you know, 2 weeks of press briefings. There's a whole lot more they can and should do to improve transparency.
Well, you swear, guys, I want to come guys, in on this. Nestor.
I want in on this.
You gave them notes, didn't you? You sent them notes, Nestor.
No. Stop.
They're right. Come on, they're right in your hymnal, Nestor.
You know, Mueller and I get back and forth on personalities and what's being said, and I've sat at a million press conferences, what I've done for 35 years as well. I do it in sports where, you know, being gaslighted in sports is usually about injuries, right? Like, that guy's not really hurt or whatever. And then you have to go figure that part of it out, like what's really going on. Vegas wants to know. There's money, gambling, the competitors. You know, Harbaugh runs the thing like Belichick, right? So that's what I'm used to. The one thing I'm really not used to that I got used to during the Trump administration, it's just straight up gaslighting, straight up getting up there and saying, there is no injury, there are no injuries, there will never be any injuries, don't ask me about injuries. That was the lying part, the part that as a writer, I always had a problem with this, and I'll put it to all three of you, that when a spokesperson says something and you know it's a lie, where do you go to, I mean, a lie, not charcoal gray and blue and dark colors. I'm talking about black and white. I'm talking about an absolute lie that you have to attach your name to. And I found for years, that's probably the hardest thing to do is explain to Joe Sixpack, he's lying from the podium and here's my evidence, right? So I the Biden thing, I think the Jen Psaki part, and Don, this speaks to you. You want to believe everything she says because she smiles and she's polite and she's very smart and all of that. The shades of gray that you spoke about earlier, Brian, versus just flat out lying, I think that that's the hardest part in all of this, is figuring out where the gaslighting is. because the last administration, virtually everything that was said was a lie. Almost everything.
We're going to have Brian go first because I know he has to jump to another engagement, and Pam and Josh are going to hang around a little bit. So, Brian, thanks. And first of all, Brian, congratulations on behalf of everyone at Baltimore Positive on a couple of little twins making their way into your life here soon. Yeah. And if for anybody who hasn't been around twins, Brian looks a lot younger right now than he will in about a year without any sleep. But Brian, to Nestor's point about the role of the press secretary, and again, I've been in front of those cameras, I've been in front of that podium, had relationships with each one of you. What I thought Jane Miller, and maybe Brian, you take this before you jump off. Jane Miller, I think Nestor made your point when she was on with us one day, and she said, "Look, I'm not even angry or upset with a Jen Psaki or whoever it is, or a Robert Gibbs. Their job, and Pam, I think you alluded to this, their job is to try to put the action or the behavior in the best light and tell us the way they'd like us to see the world. Our job as reporters is to try to see, is the way that they're seeing the world the way it actually is." That was sort of the way, I'll paraphrase Jane. And Brian, maybe just react to Nestor's point and that, and then you can jump to your other appointment.
Yeah, look, I will, Don, you know, from interactions with me, I mean, you know that that there are always people who are willing to talk to a reporter. There's always a document. There's always, you know, there are always a number of ways to come back at somebody and say, okay, I know you told me this, but that contradicts what I have here. You know, but you also have to remember, I mean, for me, it's not personal. Like in the end, like it's not my job to get into a fist fight with you. I'm going to present what I have and ask you to sort of explain how that fits in with what you just told me. But in the end, like I'll go back and I'll write the story and I'm going to quote you verbatim what you said, and I'm going to turn around and present what I have that appears to contradict or at least raise questions about what was said.
I've learned over the years, certainly with you, Brian, and Pam, and although I haven't, Josh, you didn't cover county government quite as much, but I've learned, as I said to Jane that day, when a reporter like you guys call me and ask me a question about what happened, I got smart enough to understand that you already had a lot of information on that particular issue. In other words, I wasn't normally your first call. You had done some work ahead of time. And as I think all of you know, that as Nestor said to me, the rule of thumb always is, I say to folks, you don't get two lies. You just don't. You lie once, everybody's going to think you're lying every time. So, you know, I you better tell the truth. I mean, you can say, look, I'm just not going to comment on that. And reporters may not like that, but it's not a lie. You're just saying, I'm not going to comment, but you better never mislead them. So with that, hey, Brian, real quick, give us 10 seconds before you jump. What should we look for in the General Assembly? And then I'm going to turn to Pam and Josh. But what big issue should Nestor and I be following that's going to be the story when this General Assembly's done?
Oh, Lord, I think right now the two big predominant stories outside of the budget are going to be pandemic relief and how the governor and the General Assembly bring their two plans together. And we started to see a little bit of that yesterday with the Senate. And I think you're going to see a lot of talk about equity issues, including police reform. And I think a real debate over how the state moves forward with police reform following the death of Freddie Gray and you know, some of the more high profile police involved deaths around the nation. I think those are really going to drive the session this year. It's going to be a fairly limited agenda with a couple of oddball issues that pop up here and there that happen every year.
Thanks. Appreciate you, Brian. We are with Pam Wood of the Baltimore Sun, Josh Kurtz of Media Matters, as well as Don Moeller, my partner, who's you're on mute, Don.
No, you are on mute.
Pam, Josh, I want to throw it to you a little bit about gaslighting and what you're getting from a podium, and I guess to the national issue of we're seeing this bright face now. It, you know, everything's not true, and I think the word he used was nuance.
I guess the old adage always applies. You have to remember, you know, even if your mom says she loves you, check it out. You always, as a reporter, have to bring skepticism. You don't have to automatically assume everybody's lying, but everything that comes out of an official's mouth, you have to be skeptical about and don't necessarily take it at face value and figure out as much as you can independently. Is this the truth or not? Is there a document? Was there a meeting? Does somebody else have information? And there are really fantastic reporters in the White House press corps, and I trust that they will give enough, ample scrutiny to the Biden administration.
One of the things I worry about is that, the Trump administration was so bad at telling the truth that it's made it easier for other political leaders to tell white lies and get away with it. And just because, there's a whole relativity question, and then all of a sudden you start grading other politicians on a curve. And, I think we see that even in Maryland with some of our leaders here, where, I can go to I can listen to any press conference that Governor Hogan has or a local county executive has. And I was like, that's not quite right, it's not a whopper. It may be, just an attempt to sort of shade things to make them look better. But, I think there's a slippery slope that, standards have been shattered and we got to be worried about.
Josh, what are you now? Let's really shift our focus to the General Assembly.
Yeah,
we've got vetoes, we've right. got relief packages, we've got the Senate adding to the governor's $1 billion relief package. What we've got vaccine issues. What when you gather your guys and gals at Maryland Matters? What are you trying to zero in on, and what do you want our listeners to be focusing on?
Well, I think Brian is right. I think those are, the budgetary stuff, the COVID stuff, the COVID relief stuff, and then sort of police and equity issues. Those are the big things right now. And in a way, they're all kind of intersected. And I think the debates are going to happen the way they're going to happen. What's interesting to me and what I'm trying to remind our folks about is that, the General Assembly is not a place that's noted for innovative thinking, for bold thinking, for progressive thinking. Things are very incremental, and there isn't a lot of sort of, people aren't very bold politically. And I just wonder if the times are going to demand something different this time around. Right now, it looks like the approaches are fairly incremental, but I think there's going to be sort of a more heated debate as time goes on about, can we really not do something really bold and extraordinary at this moment? And that's kind of what I'm watching for in the back of my mind.
Pam, take one issue for us, if you can, because I read it and I thought, I need some clarification myself. And it was in the governor's budget. And again, the governor has almost a $50 billion budget, 49.3. And I guess that's before he added the billion for the COVID. So I guess we're over 50 now. And there was a small line in one of the articles about the governor's budget where it said that he funded the initial framework of Kerwin. And yet people keep reading that he vetoed Kerwin and the General Assembly is going to override the veto. What is happening with Kerwin? What are the moving parts, and what does it mean that the governor funded it but vetoed it? That was, I think people need clarification on that, Pam.
Yeah, I'm glad you picked up on that, Don. I actually asked the governor about this at a press conference. So the backstory for listeners who may not be aware, Kerwin is a 10-year plan of improvements for public schools. It's pretty ambitious. It's very expensive. And it comes from funding for education comes partly from the state, partly from the counties. So this was passed over the last 2 years, a whole funding and implementation plan. Democrats were really excited, think this is really going to help public schools. The governor vetoed it, citing the cost that governments are going to have to come up with more money for it. Lawmakers are determined that they are going to override the veto in the coming weeks and therefore make it law. So the governor in his budget put in money for basically a lot of the things that would be in the Kerwin plan, even though the Kerwin plan is not law now. I didn't really
he knows it's coming is what you're saying?
Yeah. So I didn't really get a satisfactory answer from the governor because I said, hey, this looks like all Kerwin things. And he didn't really give a good answer. But I think, yes, Nestor, you're right. He's smart. He knows this is coming. It's going to be law anyway, so you might as well put it in the budget.
And, well, that's fascinating to hear because, like, I haven't heard anybody say this is going to be law on this show, right? Don, have we heard that prior to? You're muted again, Don.
I'm sorry. I'm trying to be good and mute so I can listen to the others. I think we did have the Speaker and the Senate President both indicate that they had the votes, and we'll check with Pam and Josh here to make sure their reporting still concurs with it. They had the votes to override the governor's veto. I guess the question for both of you, what effect does the pandemic have on the long-term funding of Kerwin? And Josh, I guess this gets to your point about boldness. It seems to me that many of the Democrats in Annapolis say, look, we don't have any choice. We've got to do this. Fairly bold approach. And of course, the more fiscally conservative members saying, guys are crazy. We got problems. Although I also want both of you to talk about this issue because we picked up on it from County Executive Olszewski as well as Councilman Quirk when we had him in Ballmer County, that the county budget is not nearly in as bad a shape as one might have expected as a result of the pandemic. And Governor Hogan has been quoted as saying the same thing. So I guess, boy, there's a lot there in that little salad. But number one, how do we fund, will they fund Kerwin going forward in its current format? And why in the world was not the budget more affected by COVID?
So I do think the veto is going to get overridden in both chambers. You know, the Democrats have super majorities in the Senate and House, and so they can even afford to lose a couple of people. So leadership wants it, the rank and file wants it. So it's going to happen. There are some provisions in the bill that, you know, slow down the level of funding increases if, you know, there are certain conditions in the state budget and the state economy. So I think some people, you know, refer to this as sort of like a safety, you know, a safety break or something like that, an emergency break. So, that comes into play. Why is the budget just not, the revenue's not as bad as people thought? I think, we had some doomsday scenarios in the spring, last spring, when the pandemic was still raging, and they didn't get met. And, you know, certainly you can point to any number of industries that have been hammered by the pandemic, and people's livelihoods have been interrupted. But, you know, at the upper levels of the economy, most businesses and most people are doing pretty well. And that's, I think, reflected in the revenues.
For me with Kerwin, you said something about being bold and where's the money coming from? I mean, I was going to say, and I'm far from the centrist here, but I was going to say, do we have the money to be bold, Josh? You know, that was going to be my question. And it sounds to me like we are going to be more bold than I believed an hour ago when this conversation started.
Well, I think for Kerwin, the Democrats in the legislature have a scheme for funding it. Whether it's digital taxes, whether it's tobacco taxes, it's sort of a variety of stuff. The question of, you know, other funding, other priorities or a more robust COVID relief package could come down to, you know, other taxes. And that's something that I think is going to get debated down the line, you know, again, sort of taxes more at the upper level of the economy, things that the state just really hasn't taxed to the degree that it could. I think that's going to be part of the debate. I'm kind of less optimistic that some of that stuff is going to get through, but I think, you know, I think the Kerwin stuff will for sure.
You know, we're with Josh Kurtz, Maryland Matters, Pam Wood, the Baltimore Sun. If you want to stay informed on all things Maryland and the region, you need to be reading Maryland Matters. You need to check out Pam Wood every day, either in print or in the digital version. They're both out there on Twitter, so keep up with them there. We can't, you guys have been very generous with your time. We can't let you go, though, without, you guys have been in Annapolis a long time. Can't let you go without reflecting a little bit about Senator, past President Mike Miller. So many people have weighed in. My guess is, as long as you guys have been down there, you have one or two Mike Miller stories. And I wonder if both of you would just take a little, take a moment or two to sort of reflect on Mike Miller, his legacy, and how everything's going to be so different without him.
Well, shoot, I keep saying they don't make him like Mike Miller anymore, for sure. He was...
Hey, Pam, before you go on with that, I love that because, you know, sometimes I think it's inside baseball for some of us. And some of our listeners say, well, Mike Miller, I've heard him. I know you said they don't make him like Mike Miller anymore. I want you to continue. But what does that mean? What is it that they don't make anymore?
Well, he's just he's just larger than life, big personality, wicked, wicked smart, super great, like political tactician, could see what was happening and could adapt to the times. Very like old school in a way. And, you know, some people hated him, some people loved him, agree or disagree with policy, just fascinating guy. He was a quote machine, very unguarded when he spoke always, you know, which makes him like a reporter's dream, right? Cause you just go up to him and just say, what do you got today? What do you got today? We would just fire questions at him. And sometimes you get boring answers and sometimes you get like crazy stuff that would become the story of the day. And he managed to gain the respect of the entire ideological spectrum in the Senate, from, you know, the much more liberal Democrats all the way to the conservative Republicans. They had respect for him, even if they disagreed. Hard to come by, you know, these days, somebody who could just, I mean, he was beloved in the Senate by the senators.
Josh, Pam, before we go to Josh, any particular memories where Mike Miller had a Pam Wood moment? It seems to me most reporters have a Mike Miller moment.
Okay. So here's my Mike Miller story. So I was a baby reporter. I was at the Capital newspaper. I had just been assigned to cover healthcare. My friend Dave Abrams had just been assigned to cover state politics, and there was a special session between Christmas and New Year's about medical malpractice insurance. There was some crisis. They had to resolve it by January 1st. I forget the details. So Dave and I go down there. We have no idea what we're doing. We're figuring out the special session, which is crazy. Anyway, I see a bunch of like reporters and TV cameras. I'm like, oh, that must be important. Let me go over there. And it was Mike Miller, and he was gaggling with reporters. Gaggling is, for those who don't know, it's just like an informal, you know, asking and answering questions. And so I like get up in there and I'm listening, and I have a question. I said, Mr. President, and I asked my question, and he looked me dead in the eye and said, how old are you? And I was so stunned that I just said, oh, I'm 20, whatever, you know, 25, 28, whatever it was. And I said, but how about, and I just like asked my question and he answered it, but I was just so stunned. It was so blunt and, you know, maybe rude, honestly, and maybe you wouldn't do that today, but I just was like, oh, well, this man definitely speaks his mind. So, you know, I can appreciate it. And I was a little rattled, but, you know, kept going.
You know, that is so vintage. And Josh, before we turn to you and have you take us out of here with your Mike Miller memories, Nestor and I recently had Jim Smith on with all the Baltimore County executives, and we joked that Mike could get away with things. I guess it goes to what you're saying, Pam. There'll never be another Mike Miller. He could get away with things that no one else could ever do. He was always irritated at Jim Smith, and Jim always had a really nice campaign account, very, very, very big campaign account for, you know, so that he could be prepared for whatever he decided was next. And Mike always wanted him to give more money out of that campaign account to his senatorial reelection campaign account than Jim did. Jim gave, but it was never enough. It's like the minister or the priest who thinks you can give a little bit more and you weren't giving enough. And Mike never thought Jim gave enough out of his personal account. And he would wait until some big gathering of not in private, 300 or 400 people. And from the dais, he would say, where's that skinflint? You know, where's that skinflint at Jim Smith? He is so tight with his money. And Jim would laugh and wave. And I thought, only Mike Miller can get away with calling Jim Smith a skinflint in front of 400 people. But that was Mike's ability to be able to say things that no one else did. Josh, how about the last word on Mike Miller?
Well, everything Pam said about Miller was right on. And I would add about, you know, his personalities, his strengths.
He didn't ask you your age, though, right?
No, I don't think so. the two quick things I would add, and then I would tell a very fast story, is like, just think about, he was Senate president for 33 years. I mean, that is just astonishing. And that alone just speaks to his abilities and his stature within the Senate. So, I mean, just think about that, because that's, mind numbing. And also, I just think about all the people he mentored through the years. I mean, like, practically every top earning lobbyist in Annapolis is a former top Miller aide. You know, there are people who Miller mentored who are elected officials themselves or working elsewhere at high levels in politics. And I mean, I think that says something about the man and his legacy, too. So I remember going into his office one time in the early 2000s, and I think the topic was redistricting. I can't remember what exactly the topic was, but we're sitting there and he's talking reverentially with his eyes closed about Benjamin Disraeli. Like, I didn't ask him about Benjamin Disraeli, but he's going on and on about Benjamin Disraeli. And then, like, somebody flipped a switch and suddenly he's dropping F-bombs about something that appeared in the Baltimore Sun. And it's like, what happened? I just came in here to ask you about redistricting. But, you know, that was Miller, because that was like, he was the scholar and he was like the profane brawler. It was like amazing.
Senator Casemeyer, Nestor, before you take us out of here, Senator Casemeyer recently told me, you talk about Disraeli, F-bombs at the Sun, you go down the list, said, also, that Mike Miller knew every word to every rock and roll and country song ever written. He said it was just amazing. He said there's not a rock and roll or a country song that Mike Miller didn't know the words to. So a man of many, many talents. Listen, guys, I hope you will hope you can come back regularly throughout the session for updates. It's great for our listeners to be able to hear it from two of the best reporters in the entire region. Josh Kurtz, Maryland Matters. Pam Wood, Baltimore Sun. Nestor, anything else for our guests?
Hope you guys get back down there safely very, very soon for all of us here. And if we get together this time next year, hopefully it's shots, masks, and you guys can go back down on the floor and do what you do so we can be informed. Appreciate you very much. Thanks so much for the time. Pam Wood from the Baltimore Sun and Josh Kurtz from Maryland Matters, as well as Brian Sears, who left us a little while ago, but you can catch all of that out at Baltimore Positive. On behalf of former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller, I am Nestor Aparicio. We are WNST.net. AM 1570, and we never stop talking Annapolis stuff and Baltimore Positive.